and clicked record. Dennis, it's so great to see you. So good to be chatting, as always. And yeah, I think I'm just going to hand this one over to you. You have some awesome notes prepped for us to dive into some of the things that we talked about last week with Severance with a little bit more specificity. And I'm just excited. So yeah, I'll toss it over to you.
Me too, Reese. I'm super excited. And as always, lovely to see you. You're looking stunning, as always. As always, love.
Thank you.
Just gotta point that out. But so I feel like last week we had such a great discussion on Severance. And I think, at least for me, you could see my neurospicy glee just sort of coming out in talking about all of these different things. And so it wasn't, I think it was wonderful because we're incredible. But I also don't know that we were able to get to some of the key things that we would love to have highlighted and talked about. So I'm going to try to come at this a little bit more disciplined while still maintaining our usual twists and turns. So
yes,
but what I sort of went through my notes and went through stuff I found online and just really looking for some ways to organize this for our listeners I think where we landed is just to spend some time on a few key themes that we've noticed, and would love to get your take on some of these. And of course, adding if you have any as well that I've missed that maybe I haven't thought about would be awesome. So we'll go where we go, but we'll try to keep the container of our session today to be a little bit more focused,
a little bit more targeted,
if you will. Yeah, little bit more targeted, and again, if we go elsewhere, I'm sorry, not sorry, kind of thing. But
yeah,
let's just jump right in. I think one of the key themes, maybe the number one theme for me is this interplay between autonomy and patriarchal control. And what's interesting is in reality therapy, right? One of the five areas that they talk about is this idea of freedom, being able to make your own choices. So, from one lens of a modality of therapy, one could view this as a fundamental thing that humans need, one of the five. And so I don't know, to me, I don't know, what do you, when you just hear that interplay, autonomy versus patriarchal control, what comes up for you, I guess, just even in those words before we talk about characters or anything else?
Yeah, I think through the lens of Severance, I mean, autonomy versus freedom is just like so clearly the biggest like chunk there that we see. And for that to be kind of mirrored into patriarchy, I think it just resonates in the sense that like both capitalism and patriarchy come from the position of power over. Right? Like having to hold your power by pushing down other people, not by pulling yourself up. And I think when we see characters really come into their own in Severance and also really challenging the system at hand, it is when they are pulling themselves up, right? Like the classic pull yourself up by your bootstraps and kind of making your own way. And the barriers that are placed that don't allow people to do that within the story is also really fascinating. I think the other thing that comes up is like, this is bad for everyone, right? That, no one benefits from power over, because even if you are the person in power, in a power over structure, it changes the way you think about humanity. It changes the way you think about the importance and quality and sanctity of human life, of human consciousness, which, of course, is a big theme in Severance. And if you don't value other people with the same that you value yourself, it's kind of like you get into this weird cycle of no human being is actually valuable. You're only valuable based on what you produce and create and the next level of power you can get to. So even the people in power, it harms them because there's never enough. And I think we see that constantly in our society too, played out, right? Like political figures and in big billionaire figures, it's like no money is ever enough. No amount of power is ever enough. You constantly need to keep leveling up, because if you're not, at the end of the day, when you put your head on your pillow, you're losing power because you're not exerting it over someone else. And I just think that that's really dangerous.
Yeah. God, you said so much good stuff in there, and my brain already had like 10 things to say.
Yeah, please.
I'm going to try to pick out the most important one, if I can, if my brain will actually cooperate. Yeah, just so much truth in this, the hurting of everybody. That's where my body keeps going back to.
Yeah.
It's, and the image that came up to me, and I think we even see this, that being part of this game, right, you are locking yourself in essentially a cage with no bars.
So,
yes. But you've put these, you know, it reminds me of the images I've seen on the internet with a bird that's in a cage, but literally there's only two bars and the bird is looking at, you know, looking out between two bars.
Right.
Where literally the rest of the cage is completely free practically. And I feel like we put ourselves under that. You know, the other thing is you described perfectly to me the idea of technological attunement, this idea of, you know, which, you know, is you love philosophy and. Versus, you know, I'll compare that to the poetic attunement, which is something that I'm trying to lean more and more into, versus this everything's a commodity. You know, here's an interesting thing, like, and see how this lands when we talk about the perfect woman, right? And this idea of, you know, Severance is about splitting this consciousness, right, into multiple things. We see Gemma split into multiple different things. To me, this isn't a science fiction necessarily, but it's really the patriarchy's dream in some senses, for many, many of the, it's a woman's mind literally divided and conquered. So you could have a Severance where your wife, okay, now she's the housewife who does perfect things. Now she's the perfect mom. That's a different, you know, switch on to mom mode. I mean, which we ask women to do already, right?
Right.
But what's the ultimate piece of that? Well, you know, oh, well, my wife's too busy doing chores and cleaning the house. My wife doesn't want to have sex with me anymore. We're never intimate. Well, do you help with the housework? Well, no, you know, she does that. I work. Okay, but maybe, you know, well, now if you have the chip, she's not going to be tired from doing housework, right? Oh, okay. It's fun time. And talk about the Madonna whore split, right? Like, now I can literally have my wife be a whore in the bedroom, but not have that. I mean, everything about it screams control over women in my mind.
You know,
in terms of that metaphor.
Yeah, I think that really called to mind, which I don't think we've talked about yet, and I can't believe we haven't, but the way that Severance is used in world for pregnancy and for giving birth. And it's like, that was such a bone-chilling revelation for me that was like, holy shit. Like, it's dangerously close to Handmaid's Tale, right? Where it's like you turn women into the baby-making machine, and it's like, well, who wants to only, your only purpose be what you produce for the world? Again, we can see the relationship to economics there as well. That you actually aren't inherently valuable. Only things that are separate from you that, sure, we might need you for this one little part, but we don't need you for anything else. It is the thing that's valuable that you create, but it's not you, because we can get anyone to do that. But we want a woman to be able to keep producing. It's like, well, you don't want that. No worries. We'll just turn it off. We'll just turn off the pain. And that section being about the wife of a politician, I think also isn't lost on me either. That, like, the idea of a perfect image that is politics, right, is projecting the image that voters want to see, that constituents want to see. And the family has always been a part of that, right? Like how golden retrievers pull better than poodles do, and family men pull better than single men do, right? It's like, it kind of nestles in all of that. And I do want to go back to what you said about like it being harmful to everyone too, in that we can talk all day about how patriarchy is still harmful to men. And I love this image of like, you're in a cage of your own creation. You are. Masculinity is a prison of men's own creation, right? It is something that you have chosen, not you, but the royal you have chosen to be held down by. And you don't have to be, right? I think the example of you painting your toenails is the perfect kind of anecdotal response to this. And then everything being commodified, right? I think there's a really direct relationship to the objectification of women. Not just are women constantly objectified in that their visual pleasantness is supposed to be for the male gaze, but that it's actually taken one step further into, okay, now how can we sell it? How can we make money off of it? How can we profit off of it? How can we produce something out of this for the betterment of patriarchy, right? I think there are ways, and we see this like in the sex work industry, that women can take back that power of commodification and say, okay, you want to turn me into a commodity? Great. I'm going to own that power, and I'm going to own the like benefits and fruits of my labor. But in large part, there is that other piece that comes up for me.
Yeah, you know, it's interesting you mentioned sex worker, because I was thinking, so the severance procedure, right? Well, what if you want to be a sex worker, and so you decide to sever yourself, or I mean, so now there's two possibilities, right? Like let's say your pimp severs you, and so now you turn versus, but or if you choose to do it. So again, presumably Mark Scout was not forced to be severed. Now, Gemma, we don't know, right, whether she was forced to or whether she chose to do that willingly. But I guess the question is, does it matter? So, like, obviously the one is worse, right? I mean, it's immediately obvious to me that, hey, yeah, if my pimp forces me to do this or you know, it's done without my knowledge, sort of the old, you know, wake up in a bathtub with ice saying, you need to get to a hospital, we took your kidney kind of thing.
Right.
You know? Like bathtub severance procedures, which, by the way, isn't much different than what Ragabi did anyway, as far as I can tell.
Yeah,
like a dirty-ass basement with, like, you know, random-ass medical machines, supposedly. No, but, I mean, I don't know. That poses an interesting question, though. What are the ethics here? Like, both feel icky, right? One feels more icky, if there's such a thing. But, you know, the other, so if one chooses to do that for themselves, like, okay, I want to go strip at a strip club, but I don't want to know any of this. So boom, I put on, you know, I mean, we kind of do that metaphorically, right? You know, they walk in and it's, you know, Jasmine, or, you know, and meanwhile your name is, you know, Sue. I don't know, you know, and like we all kind of do that, right? This is just taking it to the next level. So I guess the question is that okay if you're doing it to yourself versus if somebody else is doing it to you, you know?
Yeah, and I think that at least to me, the main takeaway is no, from the show, right? That it's like, in this way, isn't every single any waking up in a bathtub saying, get to a hospital, we took your kidneys? Isn't every single any saying, like, yeah, you've been pimped out and you don't have control over it. This is just your life now because someone else got the say. And it's like, why was I not consulted? Of course, how would you consult with this person? But it's like, actually, I think that there would be a way to do that, right? And one thing we talked about last week was like, you don't have to treat the innies like dicks. Like, if there was a way to say, like, hey, you've just been born, this person who has historically had autonomy over this body, has decided to do this thing, but you get just as much say in it too. Kind of what Dylan's Audi did for Dylan's Innie, right? At the end of season two, where it's like, you get to choose. You get to choose this too. And of course, that would be a long road, and it would completely, like, revolutionize the way that they think about innies. But it's like, to me, that's kind of the thesis of this, is like, where do you draw the line of someone's humanity? And one thing that kept coming up for me, this last week after our conversation last week, is a beautiful, beautiful quote from a friend of mine who did a podcast episode with me for Making Meaning. We were talking a lot about the social justice movements and how important that is. And she said, dehumanization anywhere is a threat to humanity everywhere. And I think that's absolutely what we see here, that like the dehumanization of the innies has this trickle down effect into dehumanizing everyone, right? It's like, if you dehumanize any consciousness, any life, like however we want to describe selfhood within the confines of the show, it threatens the whole of everybody's humanity.
Oh, you're right. I mean, you what's done to one of us is done to all of us in some very real senses. Whether or not you believe in non-duality or you know, I mean, there's a lot of different places you could go philosophically. But, you know, what came to mind again, sort of one thing that came, you know, I'm a big fan of Rick and Morty, the cartoon. Mm-hmm. And it just strikes me how the way Rick is towards all of the other Ricks and all of the other universes that he interacts with is very similar to how Mark Scout was dealing with his innie. They don't matter to him. It's just they don't even exist. And you know, and I think it's a perfect analogy for what we do to ourselves even today. Like, we stuff down parts of us. I mean, that's all IFS. You know, we talk about IFS sometimes. We all, you know, there's parts of us, and yes, they're not. We don't see them as separate pieces of us. We don't see them as innies or outies, you know, but we push them down in the same way we push down innies, because the eye, you know, what is the eye? Do the innies have an eye? Like, I don't, you know, and that's an interesting, because they certainly were created by my eye. If I made an innie, like, I created that innie in that sense.
Yeah.
So am I the creator? You know, does the creator have the right, what does the creator have the right to do once they've created creation? Like, on one hand, I say, okay, I'm an artist. I created a painting. If I want to set it on fire, you know, over in the moonlight, I have the right to do that.
Yeah.
Here's another question. If I let's say I create an AI and it becomes sentient, by whatever metric you're going to use that, do I have the right to unplug it and destroy it at that point? Or have I killed because all of a sudden now I'm the creator of this thing, but it has its own life. It has its own, dare I say, consciousness.
Right. Like, even if that creation or the life of the creation is suffering. And I think this, like, we could even zoom out to, like, a theological argument, too, that's, like, a really big problem with religion is the problem of evil, right? It's, like, one of the quickest go-tos for, like, why would an all-benevolent, omniscient God create us in a world that has any sort of suffering whatsoever? Why is it necessary? But it's like, even if we grant that, like, maybe it was on accident for whatever reason, take away omniscience and it was on accident, what is just in that way? Would it be just for God to go lights out and turn the world off because it's like, oh shit, I created something that is suffering and these beings are suffering? There's a quote, and I'm going to forget who said it, but it was a famous nihilist philosopher who said, if suffering is not the point of the human existence, then whoever created it did a really bad job. It's like, that seems to be a very common theme amongst the human experience. And so it's kind of like, but there is something that feels wrong about saying, well, then, yeah, God, that grants God the ability to turn lights off. It's like, well, no, we have the ability now. And that's exactly what Audi Mark wanted to do to any Mark. He was saying, your existence is horrible. You have all this suffering. You're in this prison. I'm so sorry. So we're going to go lights off. We're going to fix it. And Innie Mark is kind of like, well, hang on now. Just because from your point of view, you created this being that's suffering. Yeah, I have some suffering, but it's not all bad. We make it work. And there's something. Yeah, yeah.
Yeah, no. And again, even here, though, not only does Audie Mark say, yeah, we're going to turn lights off, but it's like, no, you need to turn the lights off. Mm-hmm. You know, shut off the lights before you leave the building and exit, you know. Lock the door behind you, you know. That,
yeah.
I mean, which is a whole new level of patriarchy control, right? Patriarchal control.
Like, yeah.
I mean, there's the, you know, again, disregarding gender, right? In this case, like, Mark's patriarchal attitude towards his Innie's autonomy. I mean, and again, we focus on women for the most part, but it's still true here too. And it's just interesting to point out. You know, just a couple of other thoughts here, and then maybe we move on to just to see what else comes up. But
yeah,
you know,
totally.
The two characters to me that, you know, I marked in here, and really a third as we were talking came up. But you know, number one is Heliar and her, you know, her Innie and her really. Like, literal, my body, my choice, being literally enacted. You know, and to me, her rebellion, her willingness to, against herself, against God, in this case, Helena, right? You know, Helena God, from Heli's perspective.
Right.
Really, to me, symbolizes that internalized oppression versus autonomy. There was a part of her that wanted freedom so badly that she was willing to sacrifice everything to get it. It's almost give me, you know, talk about give me liberty or give me death, the Patrick Henry quote that I played the role of Patrick Henry quite famously and quite well, if I must say so, in second grade. It got incredible reviews in the school gazette.
EGOT is on the horizon.
yes, I feel ripped that I didn't get my EGOT, you know, someday. So that's one, you know, I think Gemma is really the extreme example of bodily autonomy being violated. So, again, we don't know how she got there, right? So
right.
I don't want to say, you know, she may have chosen this knowing fully, without knowing, with fake promises. She could have been, right, you know, we have no idea how she, you know, how did I get here? We don't know that. Was it a kidney in the bathtub situation, as we said? But, you know, her trauma as a woman, specifically not being fertile, not being able to have a child, to me, was weaponized, right, by the male-dominated lumen, in the sense of, and again, I could go on and on in terms of the creepiness of the doctor watching, you know, just watching women, having cameras watching Gemma in every way, watching her at all times, seeing what she's, and apparently getting some sort of, I don't want to say arousal, because we don't necessarily know that, but certainly some sort of pleasure in a way we don't fully understand, out of basically keeping this woman trapped and fragmenting her. I mean, to me, that just seems sociopathic, you know, in real ways. Like, you talk about torture, you know, let alone the physical torture of, I mean, having her mouth hurt when she goes into the dentist, when this guy's not a dentist. Now, I mean, my hope is he's not, like, ripping up her, but, you know, he's causing pain to the point where her Audie's like, yeah, I feel a little bit of tooth pain. My mouth hurts, you know. And now imagine the poor Innie who's having that done to them. And that's their only existence. Like, that's all they know. You go from, okay, I feel fine when I walk in, to extreme pain. You zap out of existence. I mean, that's Sisyphusian, right? That's totally like I'm thinking of Prometheus. You know, having the birds peck out your intestines for all eternity kind of thing, you know, and for bringing fire. And then as we were talking, I'm also thinking about Helena in terms of, you know, despite being ostensibly the next leader of the company, the most powerful person at Lumen, we see in that egg scene her still being, you know, she takes one piece of control, right, in that she refuses to eat her eggs raw. I wish you'd take them raw. So, but other than that, she still finds herself oppressed despite being the one in power. And so I think that speaks to exactly what you said of how the caged, you know, when you're playing in this system, regardless of whether you're on the top or on the bottom, you're still in a cage of your own making.
Yeah.
You know.
Absolutely. I really love this kind of analogy for the My Body, My Choice with Helena that you brought up in the beginning, I think that's really so apt. And truly this idea that like my body doesn't mean anything to me if I can't use it for what I want to use it for is just so powerful. And I do think it invokes like a real fear, at least for me, the opening scene being a woman lying unconscious on a table that's very coffin-esque, it was so striking. And I think us kind of following and identifying with Helly is also really interesting. And then a woman being in Gemma's role, right? It's almost impossible to imagine a world where Severance is created and Gemma and Mark are flipped, but like we gender bend those characters. That seems odd. It feels like it would not carry the same weight. And why is that? It is because there is something like weirdly, I almost hesitate to use this word, but like you were saying with this doctor finding pleasure, there's something almost weirdly erotic in creating a subservient woman and as an experiment and seeing how she works and operates, like as a mom and as a wife and as a patient. It's like in all of the different consciousnesses that we glimpse into that they put Gemma's different split selves into, she is always in a subservient position, like patient, not doctor. In the airplane, it's like you're at absolutely no power when you're in an airplane crashing, but the flight attendant's walking by and talking to her. And what's the other one? Oh, like 50s housewife on Christmas, whose husband is saying, write these letters, right? It's like they're all subservient positions. And how do you reclaim that when it's been taken from you? You have to threaten the thing that they want from you. And I think that's what we see Helly do, right? Like in her threatening her body, that is the only way that she can make them value any power that she has, because it's like, that's what you need me for. You need this. So I have to threaten that in order to gain back any control. There was something else.
So true.
I think too, another thing that is fascinating in this is how the difference in the way Dylan and Mark interact, their outies interact with their innies. But also in this final scene, or not final scene, but the scene where Helly and Mark in the season 2 finale are talking right before he finishes the Cold Harbor file. And she says, but I'm her. There is a certain kind of identification that Helly has between her innie and outie that Mark and Dylan don't have. And I do wonder if anything within that is this kind of, I don't know, like womanly nurturing piece that is like, even if I don't know a woman at all, if I walk into a random room and there's a woman and a man, I'm going to feel more safe with that woman, right? It's like there is this weird familiarity there. I don't know. That's a little bit of a tangent, but something that what you were just talking about brought up for me.
Yeah, we love tangents. I love tangents. So I agree with everything you said, honestly, and more. I mean, I think there's so much more to be explored there and really thought about there. And the more we talk about it, the more comes up, essentially.
Yeah.
In terms of, I mean, even thinking of Miss Casey, you know, she to me could represent the patriarchy's perfect woman, right? Quiet, compliant, and ultimately disposable. She served her purpose, you know, and goodbye, gone forever. And I mean, again, it goes back to that transactional, right? We talk about people are transactional.
Yeah.
Like that's what this technological attunement that we all live in, that's only being accelerated, leads to, is the complete, severance is sort of, the end game. It reminds me of iRobot a little bit, where it's like, when you put all of these things together, what does it lead to? A revolution. Well, whose revolution? Now that's, now you're asking the right question.
Right.
You know, and anyway, that we could go off on a true rant here, but to shift focus a little bit, if it's okay, if it feels right to you. You know, the second thing I noticed is this idea of, we talked about the patriarchy, the male patriarchy, essentially. But I think there's also a little bit of the female patriarchy going on in the show, and complicity therein, in the sense of how, so for example, at least in the first season especially, obviously season two is a little different with Miss Cobell, but both Helena and Miss Cobell, I think, demonstrate how women often uphold the patriarchy, sometimes even against their own interests. So as an example, Helena clearly is empowering Lumen's oppressive practices, even though she knows herself she's suffering under that.
Yeah.
You know, the recording of that videotape of, you know, almost a, you know, how different, I mean, you know, interplay that videotape at the beginning of season two, where she's like, oh, you know, I inadvertently took some non-Lumen, which was important, right? Had to be non-Lumen skin salve, and it made me, you know, it interacted with my alcoholic beverage, so I spouted off, basically. Which, you know, I mean, which is a piece of humble pie, right? You know, it's she hears her father call her fetid moppet, whatever, you know, again, which we still don't even know of. But, you know, so again, so she's publicly empowering these oppressive practices, even though she suffers under it.
Yeah.
So, again, that's one example. And you know, at least prior to, you know, this the middle of this season where she sees the goon next to Helena and decides to bug out and go back to Salt's neck or whatever, Miss Cobell, her fierce loyalty to Lumen reflects that internalized need for her patriarchal validation.
Mm-hmm.
She wants, and she was taught to do that. She was indoctrinated into that.
Yeah.
And again, how is that? You know, so many people are, you know, like push Lumen as like, oh, Scientology, and this that, because that's an easy punching bag, right?
Yeah.
But how is it different than Christianity, man? Like, how is it different? I know there's a lot of Christians who watch Severance, and maybe they listen to our show. Great if they did. But ask yourself that question. How is it different?
Yeah.
You know?
I mean,
praise Keir. Praise Jesus. Praise, you know. And
goats,
but,
are,
it's ridiculous.
A huge metaphor. Goats are a huge metaphor in the Bible. The Lumen Handbook sure looks like a King James version to me. You know, it's like even the symbology.
Exactly. You know, so those are, you know, I noticed that, and I'm just curious your take, and maybe if you noticed other characters as well, that sort of, so we have this sort of, okay, the male hierarchy, the male patriarchy, but, and this is something I've noticed, like, even, you know, I don't really tend to watch, you know, shows, I don't want to call them reality shows, I don't know what you would call them, but sort of I know there's one show where, you know, of a Mormon family or an offshoot of Mormon family that has like five wives or whatever the case is, and sort of shows their daily life and what it's like. And I'm not typically a fan of those shows. They generally move too slow for my brain. But, you know, I have seen episodes, and one thing that comes up for me with respect to female patriarchy is inevitably there's a female patriarchy as well in that family. Like, no, it's not a commune, that I've ever noticed. And again, I'm not, if I'm wrong, readers, please point out a show where maybe, you know, it's different. But there's always a hierarchy. And often the female patriarchy is every bit as rigid as the male hierarchy, I might argue. I don't know. Thoughts there. And I said a mouthful, so
no,
hopefully you had time to process. But
yes, absolutely. I think that there's some really important stuff in there, because I think it's really easy when we're doing this work, at least as a woman, to point fingers at men, right? It's really, really easy. And for good reason, because, you know, straight white men throughout history kind of have taken on the role of oppressor and like settler, colonial, all of that good stuff. But I think it's important to be aware of the role that we all play in this narrative, that there are pieces of the puzzle that we kind of fulfill. And even in like radical, I'm going to forget the word, but like essentially to the point of like man hating feminism, like that exists. And I understand how you get there. It is still upholding the very evil that you are condemning, right? And so I think it's really hard with this trying to undo what we don't like. It's you have to get really clear about what it is that you're condemning. Are you condemning how men have treated women? Or are you condemning any life being upheld above any other? And how can we move forward? Like, what is true restructuring, right? And I think for a really long time, I had this belief that, you know, maybe burning it all to the ground is the only way that we can rebuild. Like, you kind of start from a blank slate. But the older I get, and maybe this will continue to change, I hope it continues to evolve, certainly. But the older I get, the more I'm like, you know, if you burn it all to the ground, history will repeat itself. We have to learn from our mistakes and move forward with something different. It's kind of like the, you can't fight fire with fire. And I do think that Cobell is such a fascinating case study of this. And we get the, I forget who says it, but it's like she was raised by Lumen. Right? She was literally raised by a patriarchal corporation. And to see a woman who is so in her own power, but only within the framework that she was taught, is this really weird tension. And I think to see Helena in the structure of the show, it's almost like not even being able to see past the reality that you have been given, that there is some new reality that you could construct. It makes me have a lot of sympathy for these women, because it is kind of like, there's no way Helena could imagine having any sort of control, any sort of power, any sort of autonomy outside of her family. Because if she defects, if she abdicates, for lack of a better term, she's a social outcast. She's a cultural outcast. She could not be amongst people without that being like a target on her back and a stamp on her forehead, that I am an Egan who chose not to be an Egan. That would become her narrative, that is still defined by Lumen, that is still defined by the thing she doesn't want to be a part of. So I have a lot of sympathy for her trying to find ways to hold on to power within the structure, because until you can redo the structure, you will always be defined by it. But to kind of zoom out external to the show, there is this added layer of, okay, at what point, like, is playing the game just perpetuating the game? And does Helena have a responsibility to kind of say, like, look, yeah, I am the next CEO. Dad, you're going to die. Kind of do some sort of coup and start to remake Lumen in a better image that isn't Kier's image. I don't know. Yeah, so I think it's really complicated and difficult. And for practical application, I would just urge any women that feel this tension, I feel this tension, to notice the areas where masculinity shows up for you and what that triggers within you. Does a man showing vulnerability or traits that are typically considered feminine turn you off? Does a man showing traditional masculine traits feel really exciting to you and like, oh, well, that's a real man? And sure, some of this may be biological, but think about the ways that we are also contributing to the system and the work that we need to do to continue to make a safe space for men to be allies.
Yeah, I think that's such a great point. Because I mean, just from my own personal perspective, it's yet not 100% clear to me where I play. Like what spaces are sacred spaces that I shouldn't, that I don't need to be into, or that it's not welcome. It might be harmful for me to be in. And what spaces are good spaces, safe spaces, brave spaces? Because I don't, you know, I've tried to, you know, the term safe space has been talked about a lot, right? You know, it's a safe space. And I don't know if there ever is anything such thing as a safe space, but what there is a brave space, and they're different. I think I don't know if in a safe space, particularly if somebody's has tremendous trauma from their experiences with men throughout the years, which I'm really sorry about, and I know there's many women that truly, like, you have men have abused you and hurt you in every way imaginable, and I'm sorry.
Yeah.
Which is pathetic and does nothing. And so you might need safe space to process that, and having a man there, regardless of intent, is harmful. And I respect that. But I think in brave spaces you do need men. And I think that's what we're trying to even create with this what we're doing here, mm-hmm. is a brave space to talk about things, and hopefully that leads to safety. But
right.
the safety comes from being brave and seeing that it's okay to be brave, and that it's okay to talk about these things. And
yeah,
and, I don't know. Like, that's what comes up for me there, and it's beautiful.
I think that's really important, and I wonder if part of this is, like, listening on both sides, right? That... I think your question of, like, I still don't know where it is okay to play is such a poignant one, because my gut instinct is like, I don't know how to answer that. Even as a feminist myself, as someone who tries to be an activist, right? It's like, I don't know how I would answer that, except that, yeah, there are some split spaces that I do think are just for women and some spaces that are for both of us. But how do we go about navigating that? I think some of that is on men to really listen to women and hear strongly, like, if a woman says, no, this is just for us, like, hear that and process it. But there's also the onus of women to say, be clear about that, right? Like, no, this is for us. This is where we can do this work together, and to also listen to, I don't want to say the good ones, but listen intently and with attention to be able to understand, okay, this is a time where I need to step into bravery, or this is a time where I need to set the boundary to create safety. And, like, listen to that request too. Because in listening to your question of, I don't know where to play, I'm like, I bet a lot of men feel that way. And I want that to be clear. And I don't think it can be super clear, but it should be able to be a conversation that we can have openly, while acknowledging, like, yeah, I feel a little weird right now saying that, like, in feminist work I need to listen to men. It's like, that feels odd for me to say, and yet it's like, I want to hold the tension of that because I still think it's true and important. And of course, like, yeah, men need to listen to women, but also, like, we're also asking men to speak up and call men out and do this other work too to support. So it's like, yeah, just holding that tension. So that, wow, that really hit me, Dennis.
Yeah, it's a tough, I mean, it's a question I wrestle with, even as I think about what I want to create. And I know who I want to help. I know who my calling is for. I know a population, I mean, there's many populations, but the population I'm most drawn to and feel called to needs men like me, like, needs it desperately. And the other problem is it's so, how do you tell who is in fact genuine and authentic and who's there for ulterior motives? And I think that's an energetic thing. And I think that you have to have discernment. And, you know, I believe that my energy, if you will, is I know where I'm coming from. And so if I'm misunderstood by people, well, you know, we did that meditation weeks ago. It's okay, because the people who need to hear will hear. And yeah. I don't need to worry about, if I'm true to who I am, and I know my heart, I see my own heart, I know there is no ulterior motive. There's no, I want to do, or if it is, it's deep in the subconsciousness or deep in the unconscious, you know, but there's nothing, and I've searched myself a lot, you know. And yeah, especially as I continue with my spirituality. I mean, I'm entering a space which is more female dominated in general. There's in terms of sort of the therapeutic coaching space, and I prefer the coaching side of the line for the most part, but also have the training and education and heart to be able to help on the other side, you know, in the more therapeutic side. So I know where my heart is, and I know that I'm good, that I help people because I see it in the folks I work with today. I see the changes, mm-hmm. like literal changes that, you know, now would a female therapist have had the same impact? Possibly. Would it have been in the exact same way? No, because that's impossible because of the unique relationship created. And that would be true of any other therapist that saw a client.
Right.
It's not just, oh, male versus female, but the experience would be very, very different. And not better or not worse, just different.
Well, and there's space for both, right? It's like it serves a spectrum of things.
It does, yeah. And yeah, I'd love the listeners' thoughts. Like honestly, because I don't know. I mean, I ask people, and I judge, I read the room, I read my feelings, how do I feel, and see if I feel comfortable or not. And in places where I don't feel, I mean, you can feel the energy of where you're welcome in some senses and where you're not. And you know, I don't ever want to be someplace where I'm not welcome.
Right.
Because I don't need to force myself anywhere. And I think that's the problem. You know, a lot of men who maybe try to force themselves in places that they aren't necessarily ready to be received, I think do so out of a sense of ego or, you know, male entitlement and mansplaining, and I know how to do this better, and, you know, you need me here. And yeah, I mean, I get that. That's that toxic masculine part of society that we've all adjusted to, and we've all fallen victim to, I guess, in terms of a how we see ourselves and how we see the world. So
yeah, I think that's important to hold. I know we've talked about it a lot in terms of like framing and working through this podcast and our intentions for it together, but I would similarly love to hear listeners' thoughts on that. And the same way that like you listen to like the energy of when this isn't a place for me to do this work and where is the place and time for me to do this work, I think that's just as much like my role to do as well, to communicate that when it is and isn't, and to maybe even ground it back into severance. One thing that I think is really fascinating is how Mark and Helly's relationship evolves in season one. And Mark is, you know, technically her boss, and yet Helly has so much more like agency than he does in that. And we really see her challenge him, and her coming in is really what makes Mark start to question everything. And I think that that's such a beautiful thing, that it's like Helly's, you know, Lilith's side is the thing that allows Mark to kind of embrace his shadowiness. But at the same time, like, they end up in a relationship with one another. And it's fascinating the power dynamics that are there. And I think that just Mark's deference to her and clear respect for her is something that I always found really, really cool about their relationship. And one thing that I'm like, I always think about is how in the very beginning he went to the break room for her, even when pre-relationship, pre any sort of like fondness, really, it was still this responsibility that Mark felt to, she doesn't know this, I'm still going to take this one on the chin because it is my responsibility as a leader. Like, this is my job. And I don't want anyone to go through that. And that was almost the thing that endeared Helly towards Mark too. That it's like, there are really good things about leadership as well. And there is that, and women and men can do that, right? But like the traditionally masculine energy of protection that we see in Mark there is really divine and really beautiful.
Yeah, it was done. It was done, to me at least, in watching it. It was done without any expectation of anything. So there was no, that I could detect, ulterior motive. To your point, it wasn't like, oh, you know, let me do this to curry favor with Helly, and you know, maybe we can knock boots, kind of thing.
Yeah,
like, and that's the other thing. I just want to point out, like. So these innies are all compared to be adolescents, right? Like, how are relationships, like, not a thing? Like, high school? Like, come on. Like, but now you got adults in adult bodies? Like, all they're doing is having sex all the time everywhere they can. Like, I don't care what anybody says. Like I mean, let's be real here. Like, if there's not cameras everywhere, like, I mean, forget about even sex with other people. Like, I can't speak for women on this, and I don't mean to, but every single guy is using the bathroom for other purposes. It is not,
so funny.
There's not just number one and number two, because, I mean, basically you have adolescent full-grown men standing around. I mean, like, yeah, come on. I mean, we don't talk about that side, but, you know.
Yeah. No, that's so funny, because that had not even occurred to me. And it is something that in, like, Mark and Helly being, like, what? Helly's, like, a few months old. Mark's, like, 2 years old. That when they did have sex, and also the female empowerment of after Helly learns that Mark was tricked by Helena and they ended up having sex during the Ortbo, Helly goes back and is like, the reason why I'm mad is that she took that away from me.
Yeah.
And I want my own experience. And then would you want that too? Oh, it's just so, like, pure in that. Oh, it's such a beautiful interaction. But, like, the empowerment of her to own that, I was like, lovely. But there was a piece of me that was like, is this weird? Like, at what point do the ethics of, like, minors get involved? Like, and that's just a whole other can of worms.
And one thing, you know, that to piggyback off of that from a sidebar perspective. So, you know, on that great big painting in the end, in the finale, the him finishing Cold Harbor, all of that, you know, and I think generally from what I've read and what I saw and what makes sense to me, all of the figures there are individuals Mark S. has interacted with in some way. Like, so, you know, pretty much everyone in the painting was somebody that Mark S., the Innie character, had met, worked with. And again, of course, you have all the CEOs on the top of the cliff or whatever.
Sure.
But if one thing that was interesting is the four tempers were there as well from the waffle party, which suggests to me that Innie Mark was not, in fact, a virgin his first time with Helly R., but had been at the waffle party. And, you know, Dylan managed to, we never saw the full, let's say, completion of the waffle party, but it was pretty clear where the hell it was going. And if you think about it from a conditioning perspective, that'd be a hell of a way to condition people to finish files. Your waffle party, you know, you get a happy ending kind of thing. Again, I think it's interesting. Now, Helly never really had that experience. So one could say for Helly, that was her first time, perhaps. I don't know. I mean, we know for Mark it wasn't directly because of the previous episode, but there's also inference that, you know, that's how they use to keep their workers in line. And what a female, no. So, I mean, again, and here, look at how we're playing on male-female stereotypes. Like, even me in talking about this, well, like what guy wouldn't want to go to this waffle party, you know, I mean, oh, you know, I get to have sex, you know, for the record, I don't know that I would, cause it was really creepy to me, but maybe my innie would feel differently. I don't know. Would that reward be as good for Helly if she had gotten the waffle party? Because, or is that rape at that point?
Like, right.
Would it have, did Mark S. in the innies having sex, did Mark S. rape Helena? Did Helena rape Mark S.?
That was my thought with that when we fully learned that it was Helena, because of course, you know, all of the threads and the like, her missing the switch and the dings, it's like I had the suspicion. But when we fully learned that yes, it was Helena, I was like, that is assault. To me, that was like, whoa, that is fully Helena assaulting Mark S. And kind of a gender dynamic flip that typically when assault happens, it is men in the power position over women. And that is about power, right? Like sexual aggression and sexual assault isn't about sex. It's about power.
Always.
And interesting to see Helena almost in this way that, like, for her, it was about the romance of it. But in that way, it was almost like the assault of power was against Helly in my mind, whereas the, like, physical assault was against Mark. But that is interesting with the Waffle Party thing. That's something I hadn't really considered either. And even if that's like an educational thing in a weird way, because that was another question that popped up. I'm like, how do Mark and Helly know how to do this? You know,
which birds is like, and the of bees, course, yeah.
Right. Like, how do you get around to that? And, you know, if Mark's first time was with Helena and then he learned and then he should, you know, what you can figure it out. And it's like, is that really important for the thematics of it all?
Yeah, right.
Maybe
right.
Not, but interesting to think about.
Well, and with the Helena Mark S, so the Ortbo scene, I mean, there's a third layer of power, another layer of power in that she's the CEO of the company having,
yeah.
Well, and by her own words, having sex with livestock. I mean, you know, basically, I mean, so what's up with that too? Like, you know, I mean,
but reality up in here.
or do we, you know, I mean, if it again is being in any slavery, like
yeah.
with extra steps, at which case is she the, who is she then? The owner of the plantation, you know? I mean, again, having relations with their slaves. I don't know. You know, there's just so many levels. And again, I don't know how much the writers are incredible, and we know Ben Stiller and but sometimes you create thing. You know, Ernest Hemingway talked about, you know, the iceberg. You know, the iceberg is in Severance, right? We see it on Milchek's on Milchek's wall in his office, and. Which, interestingly, the computer never got turned back on. Remember, the computer was "Hello, Miss Cobell," but we never see him on the computer, and the computer's not on his desk in any episode. It's sort of to the side. I mean, the computer's still there, but it never appears to be turned on. It's actually like facing away from his desk, you know, if you notice it. But I think that iceberg is symbolic in the sense of, I mean, we're reading all of these things into what we're watching, right? But you know. And the question can always be, did the writers think of this? You know, when they were creating this scene, did the writers think of this, or did it become its own thing? And Hemingway, you know, talked about sort of writing and this idea of the writing iceberg, where a good writer doesn't, you know, only tells his readers a little bit, but he has to know what's under the iceberg. That yeah. was his big thing. Like, okay, you tell the 10% that's on top of the water, but you're a hack if you don't actually know what's under the water. And you don't say it because you don't know it. Hemingway said, no, a good writer, and I don't know if he's true or, you know, believe what you want. I mean, he did eat a shotgun, so, you know, I don't know what life advice I'd take from Ernest Hemingway. But did the writer, you know, what part were the writers conscious of when they did this to create this iceberg? Because
yeah,
you know, we're diving three layers deep in this. Was that intended?
Well, and I do think...
Does it matter?
either the writer or Ben Stiller, one of the creators did come out in an interview and say, like, there's a lot of stuff that's being pieced together that is just, like, kind of on accident. Like, sure, there's a lot that we did do, but some of this is on accident. And I think Dan Erickson, the writer, said that the goats in season one actually was just a random thing. That they were like, we kind of want to do something weird that's just so odd and oddball. And then they kind of retrofitted to make it work, since it was something that so many people latched onto. And so there's a lesson to be learned there too, with like how we co-create the iceberg with artists as well, right? That like you're only being told 10%, but what's beneath the iceberg, I think, is so personal to anyone consuming media, right? That it's like that is kind of how art evolves. And I think it's really fascinating to think about that with human nature as well. And in all these themes that we are discussing, like, clearly there is something about human nature that wants to understand autonomy, that wants to understand freedom and liberation and the identity of self and the boundaries on these things. And clearly, with the obsession that so many of us now have with this show, there is a universal feeling of like wanting to overcome a feeling of powerlessness. Like that, it feels really universal to me.
No, I agree. Interesting. So I guess another theme that maybe, yeah, probably the last theme we'll have time to
sure
really talk to, but I think it's a, because I think we, you know, a couple of the other ones I had that I had jotted down were sort of the exploitation of female identity, in terms of, you know, Miss Wong showing this exploitation of youthful innocence, you know, and we didn't really talk too much about her because she is sort of a minor character. We still see this idea of grooming there, right? They're grooming. I mean, to me, that came out there. This grooming procedure, yeah, of
well, and what that teaches Milchek us. And teaches us about Cobell too.
Exactly. How she, and you know, it creates more understanding of who she is and why she's there. And of course, Gemma having multiple innies, again, I think I brought that up earlier in terms of, hey, yeah, is that not, you know, how is that different from being the mom, from being the CEO, you know, boss babe, the PTA mom, the housekeeper, the sexual demon in bed, you know, all of these different roles that women are expected to play, and it really just sort of, and for men, I don't know how many fragments of men, you know, I hadn't even really thought about it, but from a male perspective, okay, yeah, you might fragment yourself into work and home, but I don't think you would fragment. Like, I don't think a man would ever think to fragment himself into multiple pieces aside from maybe work and home. Whereas immediately it's readily obvious all these different places where women would be more. I mean, to me, I don't know. I don't even know. I didn't even think of this. But what do you? Does that even land? Does that track?
Totally does for me. And the interesting thing is, I was listening to some podcast last night that was talking about the work of self-love oftentimes is doing away with these like fractal images of self and realizing that it's okay to be all of who you are in all of these different areas of your life. And for me, it's like, I didn't even really consider that people don't think about that. Don't think about how they have to show up as different people in different avenues. Cause to me, it's like, there's like 25 people I feel like I am in a day. And the idea that someone may not feel that pressure to kind of code switch, is fascinating.
Yeah. It's fascinating too, for me, from my identity as being autistic, being neurospicy, right? And almost deconstructing that, you know, it's funny. I shared a good friend of mine that I had done training with, who works with neurodivergent clients, is an incredible, incredible therapist, IFS therapist, just incredible. And we catch up occasionally and had the opportunity to speak with her the other day. We hadn't talked in over a year. Just life and busy and prior to us talking, I hadn't been diagnosed officially with being autistic or with autism, it wasn't even on my radar. You know, I knew I was neurodivergent, but I thought it was just ADHD, you know, that sort of thing. And autism, being autistic, never crossed my mind. And you know, and I had spent quite a time with this friend of mine in our training, and you know, we had a nice connection. Like, you know, we got each other mm-hmm. really well. And again, I don't connect with that many people. Like most people, I kind of they bounce off of me a little bit. And one of the things with my human design, and yours as well, because we're both generators. I'm a manifesting generator, but it's kind of like the way I've had it explained to me and the way I sort of conceptualize is having these little tentacles that are just constantly going out and tasting almost. Like, you know, think of a snake's tongue, like testing the environment. And we just constantly, that's what generators and manifesting generators are kind of doing at all times. And so when people of like energy, I guess, find each other, you know, their energy tentacles, if you will, kind of mesh and work. And for most people, I think I feel around and it bounces off. Like, you know, it forms a shield. No, this isn't right. And with this individual, you know, we did click. Anyway, long story short, she we're talking, and I was just sharing sort of my experience. Oh, you know, my daughter said take this test, and I did, and you know, test for neurodivergence, and when she took it, it was like, oh, you have a little bit. When I took it, it was like, oh yeah, you're off the charts. Go see some. You might want to get that checked out, kind of thing.
Right.
Which is, and you know, so I'm sharing this experience. How then I took more tests and got more positive. Yeah, you're definitely autistic, dude. Sort of thing, and then at the end of it all, you know, she was smiling the whole time and she was very happy for me. And then she goes, you know, like what took you so long to figure it out is kind of what she said. And she said, you know, I all due respect, you know, and of course
right,
we know
love,
each other.
Yeah.
So with love, you know, but she was basically like, yeah, I don't, you know, I didn't say anything because it's not my place to say, which I get because I see clients who I know are autistic. And until they're ready to hear it, there's no point in bringing it up. Or at least labeling anyone with that,
right.
You know, no, the more I can work with somebody and say, hey, yeah, you might be neurodivergent, you know, sort of step the toe in there and then we open up the conversation. But yeah, you know, I don't even know why my brain went there. I'm sure in listening back, it'll, oh, but just this idea of my identity, you know, this idea of wearing different masks, right?
Yeah.
Like, So I think in my years of masking, you know, I struggled so much and had a real long period of burnout. I mean, really, if I look back, probably 4 years of true autistic burnout. And the reason was because in all this masking, the I that was underneath the mask somehow got lost by me. And because I had all these different masks that I would wear, based on the energy coming at me, based on the situation, and at some point, I lost the eye underneath that, and became more, you know, the there was no gestalt anymore. Like the parts were the whole, versus being more than the sum of the parts became the whole. Versus which is not true,
right?
And so the tail essentially started wagging the dog, and that caused burnout. I guess I say all that to say, in a sense, learning I was autistic was kind of a reintegration for me,
yeah.
In the language of severance, and it helped me bring back all of these multiple roles, these masks, these parts, not to get rid of them, but to celebrate them,
yeah,
and also recognize that they're all part of the whole. And
yeah.
That the more that they all have a place and that they're all beautiful and that.
Yeah.
And I think that's why I always tell people who think they might be neurodivergent to just lean into it a little bit, because if you understand it, it was such a change for my understanding of myself, and it didn't all come at once and it wasn't easy and it wasn't like light shining. But ever since then, it's changed. It fundamentally changed who I was. And how I saw myself, and you know, we need those. We need that in our lives.
Yeah.
You know,
yeah.
We really do.
Well, and I think one thing, maybe in the first episode that we did, that really struck me, that we kind of talked about, was how your experience as a neurospicy individual, whether that be oppression, suppression, difference that isn't like societally accepted, you know, any sort of kind of language we want to tack on that, allows this avenue for you to understand the experience of womanhood better, the same way I had kind of said that being a woman allowed me to understand or at least listen to like people of color or queer people that have this other form of, again, suppression, oppression, difference, however you want to couch it. And so it's interesting to look at that through this new avenue that not only is that a way that you understand and maybe are drawn to helping women because of that, like, oppression, suppression piece, but also this mask work, right? That, like, masking is so innately feminine, but also wildly a part of the neurodivergent experience, right? And it's like that really is in the Venn diagram of womanhood and neurodiversity, like masking sits squarely in the center.
Yeah, no, it does. And I think it does offer me an analogy in my own mind to understand the experience of somebody who has to put on the happy mom face. Or has to, and or even just going into work, being a woman,
right?
Like, how do you navigate the workspace? You know, and how do you, you know, I mean, again, how do you be assertive without coming across in a way that's going to get you that's going to get a mark on your name?
Yeah.
You know, how do you cry in the workplace? How do you cry in the workplace? Like, what's wrong with crying in the workplace? But yet, I know. I mean, in my time in corporate America, I had employees who were knocked against. In you know, we would do rating meetings, and oh well, she cried. You know, she's emotionally unstable because she cried a couple of times when she was having a tough day. Like,
yeah.
I don't want to. You know, that's a place I don't really want to work at.
Like, right.
Now, ideally, there's not a. And the worst part is, there's a lot of times it was something that happened at work. Like, you know, hey, if your grandma died, like, yeah, there's a reason why you might be crying. Somehow that's acceptable. But to cry because somebody was angry at you and made you feel small and belittled and, or hurt your feel, hurt you in some way, that's a normal human thing. And again, so that's what Severance tries to do away with, right? Is having that normal human reaction to mistreatment.
Oh my goodness. Absolutely. My gut reaction when you said, how do you cry in the workplace? I was like, you don't. Like, you can't. Because you are an unstable emotional woman who's likely on her period. But even further than that, which of course, whole other can of worms too. But the other thing within that, that's like, that's a normal human experience. And like, why shouldn't tears be a part of that? There is so many times I'm a very tearful person, and not that I'm a very sad person. I just cry very easily with happy things, sad things. If I ever experience an extreme, tears come. And that's something I've grown to really love about myself, is that is so there for me, and that I enjoy feeling very deeply. It's probably the actor in me. But there are so many interactions that I've had where I'll be talking to someone and I'm like, and I didn't even cry. And that's like a badge of honor that I slap on myself, that it's like, yep, I had this really hard conversation and I didn't even cry. And it's like, in some ways, yes, I understand that, because it's like, you do want to be able to like stand up for yourself without that feeling like a very extreme thing. That should be a normal thing. But also it's like, why am I proud of not crying? Thing for me to explore.
Yeah. Well, it's just so interesting that you say that, because I spent most of my life, and still do, somatically trying to understand my body. And there's been, it's certainly possible that so much has been repressed somatically. Like, my nervous system is such that it doesn't. So I go through most of my life without feeling things strongly. Although more recently, and certainly as I've been doing more and more of the work, which is why I know it works, I'm better able to feel more. And now I do, I cry much more frequently. I get emotional much more frequently. And I love it. And so my view is almost the opposite. It's like, wow, I thought about this and I actually cried, or I got emotional, or I felt, and more and more it's happening. I'm feeling it more and more, this emotion, this powerful emotion that does cause me to cry. And it's not sadness. So I understand what you mean, at least for me. It's not, right. It's not grief. It's not sadness. It's not, it's how I view it from a human design perspective, or that's my way of letting me know that I'm on the right track. If I feel something, if I feel such strong emotion about something, like I had mentioned earlier, like, okay, I'm working on Substacks. What do I want? You know, there's my ADHD mind says there's 10,000 things we could write about. Let's do them all.
Right.
And I could. I mean, I could have 15 Substacks, but that wouldn't, you know, I don't want to do, and that's what I would try to do perhaps in the past. And what would happen is I'd set up three or four of them in a hyper-focused state maybe, and I'd write one or two articles for each of them, and then it would be like, oh, all right, I'm done. Because I wasn't listening to my emotions in it. And I'm doing it differently this time, where it's going to take as long as it takes. And even saying that, I feel parts of me saying, come on, dude, we got, like, because right after this, I'm going to work on this a little bit. Like, come on, dude, we got to get going. Like, yeah. I can feel that emotional authority.
Yeah.
And so I know when I get emotional about something that's real for me. Like, that's not cerebral. And that's where I've lived so long, is in my head.
Yeah, it's embodied.
It's embodied. And that's where the truth comes from. And the more, and so part of my own journey, if you will, is to listen more and more to the body, because the body knows more than the brain does, for me especially, given my human design. I think it's wild. I mean, it is areas for exploration, right? It's amazing how much intersectionality is here between neurodivergence, between, you know, the divine feminine and divine masculine, between empowerment, in between, you know, power and freedom, and what all of that means. And again, kudos to the creators for both creating a show that. Creating a container, really, because this show to me is I think of life as containers, right? Our podcast, our time together is a container wherein we discuss certain things. And Severance to me is a container that allows us, you know, that we can discuss things in. We're discussing things in the framework of this container. But, you know, kudos to the writers and all of the creative people involved in this to create such a vibrant container that allows and affords so much more discussion, so many different places we could go.
And what I said earlier about again, I'm forgetting who said this, but someone coming forward and saying people are piecing together things that are just like on accident. I do not think that's a flaw of the show at all. I think that's part of the beauty and vibrance and abundance of everything to explore here, is that when you are doing something from this embodied, authentic is such a weird word, but like authentic space, inherently people are going to pick up on things and see things that resonate because of how it mirrors them, right? And I think that's a strength in my favorite works of art, right? Is that it does that for people.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Well, I think that's a pretty good place for us to call it a day.
Absolutely.
Amazing where we went. I love this, because it is, it's part herding cats, but also, you know, part, part finding, you know, buried treasure. I don't know.
Yeah.
You know, when we go where we, you know, I like having a structure, a framework. But I also like our ability to complete, you know, it reminds me of the quote of like, you have to learn the rules in order to know when to break them, essentially.
Yep.
And so I kind of view, we need to have some structure sometimes to know when to break that structure, essentially.
Yeah.
Because it's
totally.
I think the power is when you break the structure. But having the structure affords you the ability to actually break it. So
Yeah.
Great.
I know you said there was one more theme we didn't quite get to. I was thinking maybe just throw it out there as a comments prompt, if anyone had thoughts on this last theme,
though
we're not able to chat. Yeah.
Yeah, it's a great idea. And for me, the last theme was just the rebellion and solidarity, I'll call it, in terms of the collective struggle. And that, you know, Helly's rebellion really, she's not only fighting for herself, but she's fighting for herself and all of the innies as well. And I contrast that a little bit with Marquez, who, honestly, I'm not sure how much of his fight is for the innies and how much of his fight is for himself in the woman that he loves. And really, whatever any means necessary. I wonder if somehow he had been given the opportunity to exist with Helly R in his own space, would he have sacrificed all the other innies? I don't know that Helly would have. I suspect she wouldn't have. But would Marquez have? I don't know. But the other thing I want to notice is just the solidarity. Really, everything that changes, all of the events, particularly in season two, are really brought about and precipitated by the women of the show. They are the ones who are moving things along. Like, Devin is the one who thinks of the cabin. Gabi is the one who moves Mark into reintegration. Cobell is the one who clearly held the power in season one in terms of running the ship and was required in order to get into the cabin in the first place, was required for the knowledge. And, you know, to me, that whole rebellion does prove the strength in sisterhood, if you will, even if that sisterhood is spanning different sides of even the same mind, and or different sides of you know, the institution. I mean, again, really, I mean, Dylan by far is the most of the doers. I mean, he's the one who actually makes things happen from the male perspective. He's the one who's hanging in there, enabling them to go into the outside. He's the one who holds back Milchek with the vending machine in the nick of time. And so again, I think there's an interesting juxtaposition there between, you know, resistance, and I think it's apt for our time in the political situation that we find ourselves. You know, how can we use this as a way to see how this collective resistance can empower us against isolation and oppression? Because the only way, you know, I'm just reminded of the movie Norma Rae, which is totally dating me because I think I saw it in like middle school, where, you know, she just holds up the sign that says union and the power in that. And those are the voices we need. You know, is this collective resistance, you know, which I think themes nicely with what we're talking about here. So, absolutely. Yeah, for all the listeners, would love to hear any thoughts you have.
Love those thoughts. Yeah. I think some other quick things, maybe just to reflect on the fact that Dylan is the one at the end, kind of with the marching band. And do they say "fuck you, Mr. Milchek"? I think last line. Beautiful. And he is also a person of color and plus sized, which is fascinating to think about in terms of this masking and code switching. The unity that Divine Feminine does seem to bring, there is absolutely something in that. So, any and all thoughts, we would love to have those in the comments about this last theme that we kind of chatted about and anything else, of course, that we talked about. As always, Dennis, thank you so much for your thoughts, your feedback, for prompting my thoughts. And thank you to our listeners for being a part of our meaning, for being something that we get to come to do this work that we care about.
Wonderful. Goodbye, everyone. We'll see you next week.
Yes, we'll see you next week.
Bow Down is a weekly podcast from the Coherent Collective that explores esoteric and empowered feminism.
Please subscribe to Bow Down wherever you may be listening. And if you enjoyed the episode, please leave us a like, a 5-star rating, and a review. And if there's anyone you think would enjoy this episode, or maybe just needs to hear it, please share it.
If you want to stay up to date on all things Bow Down, you can follow the Cohere Collective on any social media platform at the Cohere Collective, and check out other content and offerings at www.thecoherecollective.com.
If you're interested in working with Reese to find and pursue your purpose, I encourage you to head to www.thecoherecollective.com/life-coaching.
If you're interested in working with Dennis to shed your mask and embrace your desires, you can email Dennis at dennis@theheartstoybox.com.
Huge thank you to Jack Corbett for Bow Down's music. You can find him on Instagram at j.corbe. Thank you all for joining us today. We're so glad you're here.
And as always, we hope you feel like you are living more coherently. And until next time, love.